Mahonasu. So I mentioned this morning that the cultivation of the four measurables and then great loving kindness and so on, as we're actively involved in these meditations, it's really designed to kind of reconfigure, recondition, or develop new habits of mind, habits that are rooted in a more authentic way of viewing reality rather than rooted in delusion, craving, and hostility, which can be very, very habitual, but then, of course, just perpetuate suffering. And so there's one aspect of the practice of arousing aspirations, the visualization, and the intentions, the resolve, and so forth, so that over the course of time they become spontaneous, they become natural, rather than the contrary. That's for the active aspect of meditation, but you've noted all along now for 5.5 weeks, when we come to the conclusion of the morning practices, the four measurables, loving kindness, great loving kindness, and so on, that we always end then just by letting awareness come to rest in stillness. In other words, not generating anything, not trying to develop any configuration, any conditioning, any patterning or habits, because just resting in stillness is not a habit, because we're not doing anything. Habits come out of doing things, whereas this is the undoing and just resting without doing. So that's not really a habit. That's not a conditioning of the mind. Conditioning comes by doing things with effort and so forth. And so there's a complementarity here, again, like the yin-yang symbol, and that is through the active involvement in the meditation, we seek to cultivate certain patterns, habits, and so forth that are rooted in reality, that are benevolent, that are wholesome. But then when we come to the end and we just utterly release, then while the first 22 minutes or so of the meditations are oriented towards the developmental strategy, orientation, the final 2 minutes are much more in this discovery mode. Traditions of Buddhism that tend to strongly emphasize the developmental, Theravada to a large extent, Gelugpa, Sakya, and so forth in Tibetan Buddhism, in contrast to the more discovery-emphasizing traditions such as Zen, Chan, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, what one finds is a different of emphasis. And it's, again, it's not sectarian rivalry. It's not like, okay, which one's right? But rather on the developmental side, if we look at the three qualities of shamatha, it's the stability and vividness, stability and clarity that get a lot of emphasis. This is what shamatha is all about. Your mind is unstable and it's unclear. So develop that which you don't have. Develop the stability. Develop the clarity. And by that way, transform your mind. So very developmental. And what's easily overlooked, and I just about entirely overlooked, when I first went into my first long shamatha retreat, having had almost 100% developmental training for 10 years. So I thought meditation is about really development, and really hadn't heard much about relaxation. You know. And so, of course, the first thing I did was burn myself out by striving so diligently and really wanting to go out and really get it, to conquer it and so forth. But where if you look at the literature, the teachings and so forth of the traditions of Buddhism that emphasize more the discovery element, then you find a lot more emphasis on the looseness, the relaxation, the releasing into the present moment, the openness and so forth, allowing to let it be. And that's where realization just spontaneously arises, but not only realization, but loving kindness can spontaneously arise when you just let go. Compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, without cultivating them at all, when you just release into that, then on occasion you'll be very pleasantly surprised by just seeing this outflowing of these qualities, wide variety of virtues, as well as bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality, just flowing out and clearly not being developed, but being discovered, and being discovered by that process of release, of letting go, of ease, of relaxation. So a complementarity there. Right? And they both have their place. And one can easily imagine how if one overdid on either one, it could lead to a dead end. And that is the obvious one, is just striving so diligently in stability, vividness, develop this, develop that, that you just get totally stressed out, exhausted, feeling you're never doing enough. You're never doing as well as you hoped. You're not achieving as quickly. You don't think you're progressing. You're not progressing as much as you wanted to. You're kind of a failure. You're definitely not doing as well as everybody else. So there's one possibility. And that's obviously the extreme. And it's just exhausting and self-defeating and frustrating. And after a while, you just want to go off and have some ice cream, you know, which sometimes is really the best answer. And then the other one is, I think you've already got it figured out. It's like, who needs to practice meditation? My dharma is my life. And I'm just in the present moment all the time. And I'm enjoying it all, except for when I don't. And I just let it, I just go with the flow, baby. You know, whatever's happening, I just go with the flow. And there's the other extreme. You know? It's quite pleasant, but it's kind of, you know, there you are. And then you just get old and your brain is so damaged by all the lack of exercise that you just quietly fade out. So something in between, something, oh, maybe a middle way would be good, that draws from both and sees this delicate balance, this wonderful dynamic between the active and the receptive, the developmental and the discovery. And then I like to back up sometimes and take a panoramic view of the type of shamatha practice we've been investigating. And of course, there are many, many others that are also excellent. But if we look at mindfulness of breathing, for example, and we know what this is about, it's really using the breath, the mindfulness of breathing, to out of a pool of relaxation, to be sure, but really developing the stability, the vividness. Perhaps the most developmental approach to shamatha is indeed generating something that isn't there at all, right? Your breathing, after all, is there no matter whether you're attending to it. But like a Buddha image or a bindu or a seed syllable, well, that's just not there at all. If you're not visualizing, you didn't lose it someplace. It's not anywhere to be found. So you have to generate the object and then focus on it. That's really pretty much 100% developmental. But you can imagine whether you're focusing on a mental image, you're focusing on your breath, you're developing skills here. You're overcoming the excitation and laxity of the mind, developing stability and vividness. And from a hedonic perspective, a mundane perspective, from an evolutionary perspective, biological perspective, that can be very useful, very, very useful. And that is having a mind that's just kind of wobbling between excitation and laxity, excitation. That's not a very useful mind, not for really much of anything. Not for agriculture, not for hunting, not for business, athletics, and so forth. That's not an efficient mind. So if we're looking for optimal performance, something comes up a lot in athletics and business and so forth and so on. If you're looking for optimal performance, then those skills of attentional stability and vividness, those definitely have some market value. Okay? The military is very interested. They want to develop good, you know, snipers and marksmen and pilots and so forth. So that can be very, very useful, right? So one can see the practical value, the mundane, the hedonic value, and the evolutionary value. Will you have a better chance of surviving and procreating, which is, you know, what it's all about, if you can really maintain stability and clarity of attention to hunt down your mate, hunt down your prey, make sure you do the right thing with each one. Don't make that up. That's bad. But having stability and vividness can be very good for the hunt, you know, whatever you're hunting. I know what he's hunting. He gives it away totally. So very good and very useful. And likewise, if we let alone the benefit for genuine happiness, no question, then we move over to settling the mind in its natural state. And we draw from the marvelous work of Paul Ekman and his colleagues this whole theme of refractory periods, how it's so damaging. It really can really damage your life, giving rise to bad decisions and bad actions. It can be very detrimental, maybe even to your own survival. People sometimes, when they get caught in a refractory period, they may have a burst of rage and then kill someone or do something really impulsive and foolish and idiotic, you know? Because why? They weren't even aware that they were in a refractory period. And then they just act foolishly, and then they go to jail, or they get killed in an automobile accident, or what have you. So clearly, this practice of settling the mind in its natural state, being aware of the emotions, desires, thoughts, memories, and so forth, as they arise, so you're able to make a choice on whether to carry through and put them into action, well, that will have a lot of hedonic value in the business world, athletics, science, education, and family, and so forth. That's going to be very valuable. A lot of people are very interested in that for good reason. So to be, again, like a dashboard of the mind, to see what's going on in the mind, that you don't discover it only after it's manifesting in behavior when it's probably too late. So again, biologically, evolutionarily, hedonically, from a mundane perspective, developing those skills together with stability and vividness, but really monitoring, being able to recognize the surging up of emotions, desires, and so forth before they manifest so that you can make a wise decision. That has a lot of, again, market value. Emotional intelligence, succeeding in business and so forth, that will be very, very valuable. So good, yeah? As well as, of course, for genuine happiness. But now in this spectrum, from let's say way over there to of generating a mental image of a Buddha, let's say, purely developmental, now we come to the other end of the spectrum. We're coming into awareness of awareness. Awareness of awareness. And in a way, comparing this practice to all the other shamatha practices, all the other shamatha practices to varying extents picks up on or works with our natural predilections. It came up in a conversation with one of you today, with Michael. And that is, we are strongly habituated to attending to objects. I mean, that's a really deeply ingrained habit, and for good reason. It's not some bad habit. But again, from an evolutionary perspective, you know, for eating and avoiding being eaten, and for mating, for taking care of one's rearing, one's young, one's progeny, and so forth, to be attending to and responding to and protecting oneself from hedonic displeasure, from harm, finding hedonic pleasure. Well, attending to objects, being able to focus on objects with clarity, with stability, very, very valuable, right? And that's where our momentum is, our natural momentum. What comes naturally to us is largely that which is biologically driven, evolutionarily driven, and then that also just tends to be radically entangled with the good old familiar delusion, craving, and hostility. Because the delusion grasps onto me as real, as separate, as autonomous, which means if it's my tribe versus Cecil's tribe, I know which one to protect and which one to try to defeat, because I have to protect my gene pool, never mind his gene pool. So that strong sense of I am and I and mine, that's going to serve you very well from an evolutionary perspective, to pass on your genes. And if the other tribes have to be wiped out, well, that's their problem, you know. And so delusion can serve you well from an evolutionary perspective. Craving, no question about it. Craving for food, for sex, for acquisition, for power, influence, you betcha. And then anger, hostility. As Paul Ekman says, what's the role of anger? To knock out or to demolish obstacles to one's desires. You want something, something comes up, arr! Let the anger, the rage come out, and that may terrify that which is in the way, or maybe it will just give you enough energy to go destroy it, you know, or damage it so much that it can't pose any more problem. Cripple it. So anger, rage, hatred can be very useful from an evolutionary perspective. Craving and greed and attachment, very useful. Delusion, very useful. Delusion of I am, this absolute separation of self and other, my side, your side. So from an evolutionary perspective, very useful. In terms of pursuit of genuine happiness, toxic. So quite interesting, right? Quite interesting. But as we come back here to awareness of awareness within the spectrum of all of these different shamatha methods, we've now come to that which is most purely discovery, because we're not really trying to develop stability or vividness, but rather discover the natural stillness of awareness prior to its getting caught up in grasping, which then sets it in motion, in agitation, excitation, or grasping onto dullness, fusing with dullness, and then just, again, falling asleep or what have you. And so it's rather discovering the stillness, the luminosity or clarity of awareness, and just discovering it, not by doing anything, but by being present, of being present or aware of being aware. And so, again, now we're not conditioning the mind. We're not developing habits. Now, one of my teachers a long time ago, Dada Rinpoche, in the mid-1980s, made a very strong point, enormously important point. And it was shamatha with respect to ethics and the rest of practice. And he said, as an overall strategy, first cultivate wholesome thoughts, virtuous, benevolent thoughts, and then seek to go beyond thoughts. But if you bring your if you never say, never mind ethics, that's for religious people and I'm not religious, I just want to develop really powerful samadhi. And those mental afflictions, whatever, I just want to develop samadhi. So you bring all your behavioral conditioning and all your ordinary, mundane, klesha-ridden conditioning to the task. What you find is that although you may want to be simply still and non-conceptual, that which is keeps on coming up is not only concepts, but concepts that are heavily burdened or conditioned by craving, hostility, and delusion. They tend to be much more disruptive than thoughts that come up that are about generosity and kindness and so forth, virtues. They don't disturb the mind nearly as much. So if you can have to have thoughts, the more wholesome thoughts, benevolent thoughts, thoughts that do not derive from mental afflictions, they're going to be much better neighbors. Right? And so this is why the cultivation of virtue, the cultivation of ethics first, to, how do you say, let your samadhi practice develop in a good neighborhood so that the neighbors, when they crop up, don't demolish your practice. They might be a little bit nuisance, kind of like, hello, 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 yeah, whatever. But at least they're not coming in and, you know, mowing you down with an Uzi. And that's awfully nice when the neighbors don't do that, I think. Yeah. But coming back, maybe in pretty close to the final point here, with the awareness of awareness. I'm choosing my words carefully, pretty close to it. In other words, you don't have a clue how long this is going to go on. In awareness of awareness, one can ask, all right, what is this all about? Well, it's really, it is what it is. I mean, it's, in a way, it's taking the fruition as the path, and you're just resting in the natural cognizance, the non-conceptuality, the luminosity of your own awareness, allowing the bliss gradually to arise. And so what pragmatic value? If we go back to the, what's the evolutionary value? Will this help you survive and procreate? I don't know if that's not all that attractive. You know, if you're really trying to show off, you know, trying to attract a mate. I think you probably find somebody more interesting, you know. Maybe a little bit of dance, a bit of tango, anything, like, or just bare your breast, anything, you know. Either way, it'll be more interesting than just. So for procreation, I don't think it's that good a strategy. I haven't tried it, but I don't think it'd be a very good strategy. And then for survival, I mean, you may as well put a sign on your head, eat me, you know. I mean, really, eat me. I mean, you know, I'm just waiting here as lunch because I've withdrawn my awareness from all appearances. So, you know, rabid dogs, tigers, wolves, mosquitoes, anything. It's just kind of like lunch is waiting. No defenses are up. I'm completely vulnerable because I'm just resting my own awareness. So I think this practice in terms of biological evolutionary value is kind of comes out with a big zip, right? But then you think, okay, awareness of awareness for the business world. Come to a business meeting. I think that's a fast track to be getting fired myself. Very peaceful, but about as useful as a chair, except for it's not, because you can't sit in his lap. So this is the one hedonically. Number one, you're withdrawing from all stimulation, so hedonically, this is a total dead end, right? Because hedonic pleasure is coming from stimulation, and you're withdrawing from all stimulation. So even if there's hedonic song and dance going on, you won't notice it because you're deliberately withdrawing your attention from it. So this is completely come on up, zip, evolutionarily speaking, biologically speaking, hedonically speaking, mundane speaking. It's really useless. Really useless for that side of the ledger. But how about genuine happiness? And there you are, turning your awareness away from all hedonic stimulation, resting with no stimulation at all, and then like that hot coal burning through the snowbank, just coming right down to the very source of the bliss that is innate to your own consciousness. So it's really quite simple. It's just all genuine. It's all about eudaimonic well-being. And if the other shamatha methods, and again, there's a much wider variety than I've alluded to, if these could be useful in a myriad of ways in the mundane world and pursuit of hedonic well-being and so forth, they can be very useful within the context of this life. you know, in a myriad of ways, for getting a mate, getting a job, and so forth and so on. They can be useful. So really, attention skills should be taught in all schools everywhere, because you know, even if you have no interest in eudaimonic well-being, it still can be really helpful for hedonic, because we know ADHD is not attention deficit hyperactivity. There can be spurts of creativity, but overall, it's called a mental disorder because it is kind of debilitating. So the other ones can be very useful in the context of this life. That is, these other shamatha methods can be very, very useful in a myriad of ways, which is a good thing. That'll make them more popular, more interesting to a wider segment of the human population. But when we come to this one, this odd one, the odd one out, because all of the other shamatha methods are shamatha with sign, with a target, with a vector of your attention. And this is the only one, and kind of like there's no other space for another one. I mean, if you're practicing shamatha with no sign, there's no variations on that. I mean, no sign just means no sign, so you're just staying home, right? And there are all kinds of things you could go out to, but there's not a whole lot of ways to just stay home, because they've just withdrawn the vector and resting right there. And so when you're resting right there, you've positioned yourself to just dissolve right down into kind of this geyser of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, so that it rises up to meet you, so to speak, and embraces your awareness. Your awareness becomes or is nothing other than substrate consciousness. So although this has, among all the shamatha methods, perhaps the least practical value in the world, hedonically, evolutionarily, and so forth, this is the one that may be the most valuable when it comes to facing the transition of moving from this life to what is not this life, to death. Because there you are, you're releasing all awareness of your body, you're releasing all awareness, interest in the mind, and allowing it just to shut down as if it's just totally going to sleep or going comatose or dying, and you're just resting in awareness. Well, of course, that's the ride that awaits us all. Right? All of us. Anybody who's going to die, this is the ride that awaits you. Your mind will dissolve. It will settle in its natural state. You will lose your awareness of the sense of all of the sense fields, including your own body. That's a given. It may happen really quickly, as in an automobile accident. It may happen quite slowly, if you're just very, very old and gently releasing this life. One way or another, though, fast or slow, conscious or unconscious, it's going to happen. And so this practice is right there, training to die lucidly, and not only be lucid in the process, but lucid in the culmination of the process. And that is, as I've said, the dead zone. When your mind has simply shut down, your brain is no longer acting as a neural substrate in dependence upon which your psyche emerges. And I did choose my words very carefully there. And I think it's just flat out accurate. What does the brain have to do with the mind? An enormous amount. That's what the neuroscientists are so brilliant at revealing for us. This part of the brain for this type of perception, this type of memory, this type of discernment, this type of fantasy, these emotions, these desires, and so forth and so on. So the brain, the activities of the brain, are profoundly implicated in the generation of this whole array of mental processes for which we give the umbrella term psyche. So, I mean, it's brilliant science. It's a marvelous science. And there's no reason to criticize, you know, now why in ways it may go astray or be a bit kind of mushy thinking. But the science is really, really good. And so there's an agreement here that as you're becoming brain dead, either swiftly, like an accident, or just slowly, the whole system just shutting down, the brain is just no longer able to support the generation or contribute to the generation of the psyche, and just phase by phase, it just shuts down. And if you simply equate the human mind or human consciousness, there's a word, if you equate the whole bandwidth of human consciousness with the psyche, then it's a very reasonable conclusion that when you die, you just vanish, because the psyche is nowhere to be found. And that's true. If you look for it, if you could be psychic and say, oh, if you could be psychic and look for somebody else's psyche when they're dying, you'd say it's disappearing, 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 gone. And if you don't see the substrate consciousness, what else would you conclude other than it just disappeared? And that's termination, and that's being realistic. It is being realistic if that's all you see. But if you spent, you know, 5-10,000 hours in this kind of practice, and you start tasting, some of you have already been tasting the substrate consciousness. You know, it's not something you have to necessarily wait for years for. If you start tasting that, knowing it directly, then you see, aha, that's deeper. That's not my mind. And is it generated by the brain or not? Well, that's a good open question. The Buddha say no, and then we can see why. You can explore why. But there it is. Your psyche is dissolving into the substrate consciousness. And when it is completely dissolved, and for this lifetime, irreversibly dissolved, then you're dead. And if all you see is psyche, then you become obliterated. But if you see the substrate consciousness, you say, ah, that's what it dissolved into. And you may remain there. If you're lucidly dead, you may remain there for hours. Not in the clear light of death, just in the clear light of substrate consciousness. Just hanging out, just enjoying, well, quietly, being dead for a little while. Until that the bottom falls out of that, and then, you know, you're off to a new adventure, the clear light of death or the spontaneous manifestation of Rigpa. So in conclusion, in terms of a straight preparation for dying lucidly, which of course does have benefits in this life, but not so explicitly as the other shamatha methods. But this one is really the straight arrow. Really the straight arrow for dying fearlessly, for getting used to releasing all that we identify with as I and mine. Because, boy, that's really the core of this practice. You're not trying to do anything subtle with thoughts and emotions and trying to attend to them without grasping and so forth. You just say, finished, not interested. Like, as if, only as if. You're just ready to die right now. And I'm wishing you all a very long life, so no misinterpretation here. But for the time being, it's just whatever going on in the mind, it's not interested. So disappear, don't disappear, but that's not my business right now. I'm just going to tap into this continuum of consciousness. There's no beginning, no end. And experience that while I'm still alive, and hopefully still alive and healthy. So I get a big, important, life-transforming sneak preview. What's it like? Is there some element of us that didn't begin at conception, doesn't end at death? And can we know that in this life while we're still healthy? And can not only one person, but two persons, and 10 persons, and 20 persons, and can they explore this themselves and make discoveries that are replicated one after another in very sensible, transparent, rational methods, such that when the discoveries are made, then one say, yeah, but that's a discovery. Multiple people made it. They came in from different vectors. They discovered the same thing. This must be true. And whether they're Taoists, they're Hindus, they're Christians, they're Kabbalists, they're Sufis, they're Buddhists, coming in from very, very different perspectives, theistic, non-theistic, polytheistic, monotheistic, and so forth. But if this is true, then it's as true as gravity. It doesn't matter what your religion is, doesn't matter what your ethnicity is, doesn't matter what century you're studying it. It's one of those things. It's kind of like just, well, one of the core themes of nature. And I think that's how they should be approached. It's either true or not. But it's not a Buddhist truth. It's either true or not. And the way to find out is to examine closely, like for every other branch of science. And this we call contemplative science, because we're really taking first-person experience seriously. And of course, when all is said and done, first-person experience is all that anybody ever has. Scientist, poet, novelist, whoever you are, nobody's got anything other than first-person experience. And third-person inquiry is simply a corroboration of multiple people's first-person experience, but it's not another perspective. And so if multiple people looking up at Jupiter and they see that there are moons around it, and we say, ah, we've confirmed it from a third-person perspective, that doesn't mean anything more or less than a whole bunch of people with first-person experience corroborated each other's experience. They didn't corroborate something that exists independently of everybody's experience, which would be the God's eye view. They've corroborated each other's experience, and that's good enough to make a scientific claim about this is true, because it is invariant across multiple cognitive frameworks. So likewise, whether you're coming in as a Sufi, as a Taoist, a Christian, a Buddhist, and so forth, different cognitive frameworks, if you're coming in and the method is rigorous, and that means you should carefully scrutinize the method, just as if you're going to look through Galileo's telescope, you want to make sure, tell me about the telescope before I look through it. I want to make sure that it's a telescope and not a kaleidoscope. If it's a kaleidoscope, I might discover a lot of things, but they're all artifacts of the instrument. which means they can be a lot of fun, but they tell you nothing about anything outside of the instrument. It's just a lot of fun. They're self-generated images. So you'd really want to know, okay, Galileo, is this an instrument that can tell us something about the nature of stars and planets, the sun and the moon, or is it just telling us about the odd configurations of the lenses in your telescope, right? And so it's a major issue. It's a major issue. It crops up time and time again in science. When you make an observation, this came up in Richard Davidson's study of this yogi who passed into clear light of death, remained there for 17, 18 days, and got some results. And they don't know yet whether the results were an artifact of the system measurement or whether it was really something generated by the yogi's brain. And so these are very careful scientists, but they take that extremely seriously. It was a great anomaly, what they came up with. But then where's the anomaly coming from? Is it the anomaly from this person's brain, the yogi's brain, or is it an anomaly because of a little jinx in their measuring system? Just like those neutrinos that they thought for a while traveled faster than the speed of light. Oh, that'd be really cool if that's the case, except for it turned out to be an artifact of their system, that it was their own system that was at fault and not discovering something amazing about material particles that travel faster than the speed of light. So likewise, whether it's in neuroscience studying somebody's brain, whether it's in high-energy particle physics, or whether it's in contemplative inquiry, the same theme always holds. And that is when you're making, and it relates to the topic yesterday, whoever asked the question, about mediums. Okay, are they really? I mean, there it is, the same question, isn't it? There's a medium, and he looks at somebody and says, I'm picking up a dead relative of yours, and this is what he says. And then you relay information, okay? Well, very interesting. But the only question that matters is this an artifact of the medium's own mind, imagination, speculation, intuition, whatever, either self-delusion or deliberate intention to delude others? Is it an artifact of the medium's mind, which means it's an inside job, very, very plausible, or does this person actually have access to someone else, which is then not an artifact of the medium's mind, but actually gaining access to and maybe communication with a dead relative, which certainly makes us be living in a very different world. Since I've touched on that, I can give a very, very, very brief little addendum to that. I gave the Buddhist possible explanations yesterday within a Buddhist framework, but one more, and this will be very short, is the duration of the bardo. In classic Tibetan Buddhism, it's very standardly said to be 49 days. Okay, your bardo may be shorter than that because you have these little mini deaths within the 49-day period. But pretty much 49 days, in terms of a literal interpretation, 49 days, and you know, be on your way. Pure land, lower realm, higher realm, but whatever. Okay, your lease on the bardo is finished, expired. Now I have to go someplace else. But there is discussion about that 49-day limit among very knowledgeable scholars within Tibetan Buddhism. What exactly is it about 49 days? It's not even a nice month, like a lunar cycle. It's not a nice annual cycle. It's 49 days. Why? Why 49 days? Why does that have to be the absolute limit? And then you get kicked out and have to be born someplace. And if one brings this in the 21st century, even the 20th century, or even earlier, we consider, well, what constitutes a day? What constitutes a day? It's 24 hours, and what's up with 24 hours? Well, that's how long it takes the Earth to rotate, isn't it? Right? But if you lived on another planet with a faster rotation, then the days would be shorter. If you lived on a bigger planet, the days would be longer, so that means their 49 days would be different than our 49 days. So does the duration of your bardo experience depend upon the speed of rotation of your planet? Why? I mean, what? That just seems like, why on Earth would the duration of bardo have to do with how quickly your planet is revolving? Why should that be the case? So there are some people who say, well, that's an approximation, or it may be somewhat symbolic. It may be longer. It may be longer. And off the top of my head, that seems to be, you know, insofar as if we really take seriously this notion of mediums, that they are on occasion actually contacting dead people. And it'd be awfully interesting to know whether it's true or not. I think we really should be open and very critical. But to my mind, not just my opinion, maybe that's worth about as much as this napkin. Most likely, I would think they're still in the bardo. And maybe the bardo goes on longer than, 49 days. Because in the bardo, for a considerable period within the bardo, you actually, it's a dream-like. And in a dream, you may very often look very much like you do in the waking state. And instead in the bardo, you do for some time, you're taking on a form, it's completely mind-generated, including the clothes you wear, and how old you look, and so forth, completely mind-generated. But that's how you look to yourself, and that may be indeed how you look to other people in the bardo. When different bardo beings see each other, they will be seeing these mind-made, dream-like apparitions based upon the memories from the past life, and they will look like that. They will look like people, except that they do odd things, like walk through, pass through walls and move instantaneously from here to there. But they still will look human, but human as in a dream. So what if simply the bardo lasts longer in some cases than is generally thought, the 49-day limit, in which case they would look like the elderly grandpa who died, a year ago or 6 months ago. It still looked like him. He's seeing himself in that way. He has vivid memory of his past life and his dead relatives. He might want to say something to them, right? But he's just there for a while. It is a kind of Buddhist limbo. It's like hanging out in a train station. And some people may hang out for 20 minutes, and some people may actually, especially in India, they may stay quite a long time. They may camp there. But, some people spend a longer time. So that actually strikes me, rather than trying to go to Pretas and Devas and so forth, it seems to be most plausible. But we come back. So awareness of awareness. There it is. So today we'll go into the penultimate, second to last phase, probing in to see if we can tap into the deepest layers or the innermost layers of appearances with which we so easily identify. It may be as you're probing inwards upon the observer, right? When you're probing inwards, you might want to check, as you're doing that oscillation, releasing into space with no object and then averting in, you might want to check, do you have a sense of gender? When you're probing in on the observer, male or female? And if so, what's the indicator? Lipstick? Exactly what body part comes up when you're probing in the observer that makes you think this or that, or young or old, or ethnicity and so forth. But when you're coming in and seeking to observe that which is observing, not the agent, because you're not doing anything now, just the observer. Observe closely to see whatever appearances arise. And the idea, of course, is to see the appearances as appearances and not see the appearances as a person, namely me, the observer, who's in here and totally not over there. To see an appearance that has all the substance of a mirage, a reflection in a mirror. See it for what it is. And then see it, as it were, from inside, from the other side, the inner side, looking out on these apparitions with which you had previously identified, and so that you allow your awareness to dissolve through, to pierce through the various layers of appearances with which we easily identify, so that you can just go right back to ground zero, and that is awareness with no appearance, the awareness that illuminates all appearance. So, now I've front-loaded the meditation. Step by step, settle your body in its natural state. Respiration in its natural rhythm. And then let your mind dissolve into the present moment, into simply being aware, relaxed, still, and clear, and with no object. as you rest ever so simply in the present moment. Let your awareness of being aware rise up to meet you and rest in that simple knowing of being aware. And if you can hold your own ground with confidence, then simply remain there. Keep it simple. But when you lose confidence or you lose stability, your attention starts to waver into excitation or become shrouded by dullness, then at least for a little while you may start the oscillation to arouse and release, as you've done before, right into the very experience of being aware. Then at your leisure, deepen the probe of the oscillation right into your own experience of being the observer, the one in here, attending. And as you probe inwardly into this inner sanctum of your own subjectivity, see what appearances arise to the mind. Note whether you identify with them. Observe these appearances for what they are. They are just that, appearances. And observe them from the perspective of luminous and non-conceptual awareness. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Un lasso. I must say, I actually really enjoy stepping back from the practices on occasion, just to take in the bigger picture. So now just a couple of brief comments on that regard, these three shamatha methods. Learning how to breathe is actually the prelude to mindfulness of breathing, right? But that's settling the respiration in its natural rhythm. I think a lot of you discovered that's not that easy, to really deeply relax and really let the body totally take over while you're closely attending to it. It's very easy when you're deep asleep and you're completely out of the picture, then the body does a great job. That's why you wake up so refreshed in the morning. That's my speculation. But to let the body totally take over while you're closely attending to it, now that's a skill. But if you learn how to breathe, learn how to just let that natural flow of the respiration continue, that will serve you well for everything you do for the rest of your life. I was just alerted to the fact by one, I think he's a professor at Stanford University. I think I mentioned this earlier. We were speaking to this large group, remember? And he said, everybody whip out your iPhones or your iPads or whatever and check your email. And then he said something, I bet a lot of people resonated with it. As you are watching reading your email, checking to see what was up, check, did you stop breathing? And I bet he asked that question because he's asked it many times before. You get really intense, what's up? No breath happening. The intensity, the grasping, the hope, the fear, the desire, the aversion, the uncertainty, what are they going to do to me now? You know? It makes us pause. It breaks the flow. And we forget to breathe. Not a good idea. And that's probably the tip of the iceberg. I'll bet you it's not just when we look at email. That natural flow, that gentle, undulating, effortless, out and in and out, and I'll bet you that gets broken up a lot whenever we really start paying attention to anything. If it's what's so special about email. So learning how to breathe, learning how to just let that breath flow and flow and flow in business meetings, driving heavy traffic, at the grocery market, doing your work, teaching, talking, listening, whatever it may be, that could be enormously useful, let alone cultivating those qualities of relaxation, stability, and vividness. That's bound to be really good for the whole of life, including getting a good night's sleep, right? So that's a big sales pitch for mindfulness of breathing. Settling the mind, a lot of the perks are obvious, but just to go to one of the unique qualities of this particular practice, of really learning in a continuous, very composed, very focused fashion to recognize mental events as mental events and not do what we ever so frequently do, and that is completely and semi-consciously conflate our thoughts with the reference of the thoughts. Some idea comes up, such and such a person is this, and we just think, yep, that person is that, without recognizing, wait a minute, that was just a thought. Maybe that person is not quite as simple as the thought that just came up to my mind, where I summarize that person with one adjective. Maybe the person's a little bit more complicated than that, who knows, you know. And so to recognize mental events as mental events from moment to moment to moment, tremendous boon. But then what's that good for? Well, of course, directly translates over to lucid dreaming, where you're recognizing the same thing. Instead of thinking, oh, that's that person, that's that person. Oh, that's a locomotive. This is a person coming to attack me, which none of that being true. In other words, conflating the appearances with the referent, but there is no referent. It's just appearances. Within the lucid dream, recognizing dream appearances as dream appearances. So the parallel is just flat out obvious. And then how much less we can suffer in the waking state, recognizing mental events as mental events, in the dream state, dream states as dream states. Number one, you're free. Now you're lucid. Now you can start playing, exploring this magnificent self-created world of the dream state. And so there's an extraordinary perk, added advantage, benefit, of settling the mind in its natural state, the natural segue into lucid dreaming, dream yoga, and then that can really open up into tremendously profound spiritual practice for investigating the very nature of consciousness, both in its cognizance and its luminosity or luminous aspects. But then, as if that's not enough, you know, I'm like a salesman here, and moreover, there's another advantage, and that is if you develop that ability in the waking state, recognizing mental events as mental events, in the dream state, recognizing mental events as mental events, then when you are dead and not only dead, but gone, dead and gone, which means you've gone someplace else, which means you're no longer in this physical, tangible world with a physical body made out of atoms and molecules when you're in the bardo. And everything you're experiencing is the bardo, recognizing the bardo as the bardo. Then you have the comparable freedom to recognizing the dream as the dream, and you say, oh, I'm in the bardo now. Not mistaking it for anything else, like thinking you're still alive or what have you. Not being bewildered, not being terrified, any more than you're really terrified in the midst of a lucid dream. What's to be terrified? Yeah, it's a dream. So guide it, direct it where you will. You're the artist, you're the potter, shape your pot. And likewise, if you're really clearly lucid, unafraid, totally present, relaxed, stable, and clear in the bardo, and you're recognizing the bardo as the bardo, then, you know, ride your horse where you will. Direct it where you will. It's your choice. And you can actually make a conscious and wise choice because you're recognizing the bardo as the bardo. That's kind of a big deal. That's the primary reason why traditional Tibetan Buddhists practice settling the mind in its natural state. And I'm sorry, dream yoga. Primary reason for doing that is not just to have really cool experiences in this lifetime, but to become so accustomed to recognizing the dream as a dream that you're all primed for recognizing bardo as bardo and then freeing yourself in the bardo. So there's the perk from that, and this one is quite clear. If you're really interested in the nature of consciousness, then this is exactly a strategy for fathoming, just cutting right through. It's kind of like psyche, okay, leave that to psychologists. You deal with it. I'm going to be dead soon. And so this psyche is just like a little short story. It's a poem. It's so short, you know, that why should I be that interested in it? I mean, it could be ending tomorrow, this little short story of my psyche. Any time, but what is certain is it will be ending. But if there's something that doesn't end, I'd like to know about it before I'm there. And if anything doesn't end, it's not going to be the body, because we know what happens to the body. Hold your nose. We know what happens to the mind, becomes a memory at best. If anything continues, it's a substrate consciousness. So if you'd really like to know, is anything continue or not, here's the fast track. And you see, it doesn't require any belief system. You don't have to already believe in the substrate consciousness to practice this any more than you already have to believe in the moons of Jupiter before you start looking through the telescope. See what's there. So each has quite extraordinary perks. That's my sense of it. Now, our time is short, of course, because I've been so articulate. You can find your own adjective. And so what I'd like to do now is questions, because some of you are still feeling a little bit wobbly, or there may be some uncertainty, a lack of confidence in awareness of awareness. Anything today about awareness of awareness? Because we're coming to the end of the third cycle. So anything coming up? Point of clarification or exaltation, jubilation that you've broken through? We'll go back to John.
Where does the introspection come in? With this practice, where I'm starting
closer from, to your mouth.
At least where I'm starting from, you know, I have to check every now and then that I'm still breathing.
Sure.
Regularly or whatever.
Yeah.
So can that be part of the oscillation or?
Understood.
Anyway, that's the question.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, the oscillation itself is not an enactment or doesn't directly involve introspection. It's simply a directing of mindfulness, releasing into space, inverting into awareness. So that's simply an exercise, like calisthenic, of mindfulness. Of course, in this context, introspection has three roles or three things to monitor. Each one of it is quite important. And one is your posture, just checking up. But again, the more accustomed you become, and the supine position is pretty easy. I mean, you just flake out and then remain flaked out. That's pretty easy. But if you're sitting, you do want to make certain that you're not slumping over or losing your balance and so forth. Because that can actually damage the body, pull muscles and so forth. So you want to be periodically, insofar as needed, checking up on the body. And then do very much, especially in the early phases of this practice, do check up on the respiration. Because I know from my own experience, this practice is so intense, so vivid, so right on the spot, it can easily cause you to start restraining the breath. And that's not good. You want it to be as effortless as if you're just lying on your back daydreaming, just flowing in and out, even more so. So do be monitoring the breath, the flow of the breath, that it's continuing, not that it's normal, but it continues to flow effortlessly without restraint. It's those two terms. Effortlessly, you're not pushing it in, pulling it out, and it's not restrained or inhibited in any way, right? So there's that. And then introspection. Now, what I found that's been kind of interesting to me, while I've read quite a number, received many teachings, but also read now classic texts, multiple ones from multiple traditions, on awareness of awareness, sometimes called by different labels, that there's very little reference, if any, to introspection for that particular method. Quite interesting, because the other ones, it's very explicit, right? And so does this mean it's simply useless? And no, if when you're doing this practice, if you lose your mindfulness, your mindfulness just gets caught up and you're carried away by distraction, by distracting thoughts, then, of course, you need to recognize that and then apply the antidote. And here, just nip it, you know, just cut it. It's not just releasing, grasping onto it, just cut it, like that, obliterate. And likewise, if you're getting a bit dull, a bit spaced out, just sitting there with a blank mind, not really knowing much of anything, then you have to sharpen up right there, Johnny on the spot, right there. So you do need to be aware when you're getting derailed or slipping off the track, so to speak. So there it is, yes. So introspection is necessary. And so when you see you're getting kind of sloppy, you're kind of just meandering a bit and then spacing out, and then, okay, time for oscillation. You know, time to do some, you know, give me 10 push-ups. Something like that. If a person's just kind of lollygagging around, okay, soldier, give me 10 push-ups. Okay, 10 oscillations. I'm for it. You know, whether you count them or not, but then give yourself something to do to freshen up, to vitalize, to invigorate, to sharpen up your awareness, and then you can come and settle, but do the calisthenics as much as you like, the inversion and release, or the much more elaborate one that we'll do tomorrow afternoon. So introspection is valuable for that, but then we can ask this question, why isn't it so prevalent? Why aren't there so many, at least in my reading, so many references to introspection for this practice? Why do they just talk about the practice itself? Boom. And my sense of it is that if you're right there, if you're resting right there, and your focus of awareness is immediately in the present moment, in that awareness of awareness, and you have in that same awareness, without multitasking, in that same awareness, you are immediately and acutely aware of the emergence of any thought and immediately snuff it out, because that's a job, like that swordsman deflecting the arrows. If that's what you're doing, then you don't need any help. You're doing everything that needs to be done. Because where you're staring is kind of like looking right into the mouth of distracting thoughts. Where are they coming from? They're coming from the substrate consciousness. But you're resting right in the substrate consciousness. You're not looking at the breath or the space of the mind or thoughts and images or breath sensations, all of which are a bit off target. Now, you're like a cat that's staring right at the mouse hole. And so as soon as even a whisker shows up, that's right where you were looking, right? And that is, you're looking not at where they display themselves. You're looking where they originate from, because all subjective mental processes emerge from the substrate consciousness. So if you're resting right there, then that's it. That's the practice. And if nothing's happening, just stay there. And if anything comes up, blow it out, like blowing out a candle. Just release it immediately. And then you don't have to complicate it with anything else. That's it. It's really simple. It's almost too simple. People then get confused thinking, I must be doing something more. No, don't do anything at all. Just be aware right there. That's it. Okay? Good. Anything this side on this practice? Yes, Bruce, go ahead.
Your instructions about looking to see gender or whatever kind of went right by me. It doesn't really line up with my experience.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. That's all then, I guess.
Yeah.
Because really, I mean, if I'm really there, then I'm not really there. There's just no form is just coming and going.
Quite so. Yeah. Quite so. Yeah. If you're already there, then you don't need to look. This is why that probing inwards to try to observe the appearances of an agent, observe the appearances of an observer, why that's not there. It's just, there's no reference to it. in many of the discussions of this practice, because it's just not necessary for everybody.
Could you say that one more time?
Sure. In many of the classic explanations of this practice, there are no references to oscillation at all, let alone the whole gymnastics, you know, up, down, right, left, and all of that. It's just, Tsongkhapa is the shortest, you've heard it many times now, just rest in the sheer luminosity and cognizance of awareness, boom, that's it. Or the other one from Maitripa, one of the great Mahasiddhas from India, is it's kind of this process of exclusion or what's left over, and that is, okay, rest your awareness right there. If any thought comes up, nip it immediately. And then what's left? And now we come to that complex negation. Okay, what I'm experiencing now is the absence of thoughts and the presence of, and since you're not attending to anything else, not deliberately, and there are no thoughts arising, because you snuff them out as soon as they arise, since you're not attending to any appearances, and you've snuffed out thoughts as soon as they arise, the only thing left is awareness, and that's what you're aware of. So it's a very simple 1-2 strategy, and boom, you're there. So most instructions are of that sort, and I very frequently teach Padmasambhavas, because it provides these increments to get into it, and a lot of people find that helpful. But again, if it's not necessary, and this is how I began the session, if you can just stay there, then don't mess around. Don't make it complicated. That's all good. Yeah. Good. Left side, anything else coming up about this practice? This is really good. We're coming down the final slope of the retreat. Okay? Miles.
So in that last one, you were saying you want to get rid of everything, and then what's left over is the awareness of awareness. So when you notice, let's say...
Just like an ice cream cone?
When you notice, let's say, a bodily sensation, or I have this sense of retreating inwards, is there a locality to this awareness of awareness? And if not, I have trouble knowing where to focus my attention.
If you think of a locality as a sign, a place inside my head, my chest, above my head, six feet in all directions, whatever it is, it's just one more appearance. It's one more appearance. And so it is withdrawing, and we do say, and this is in Sanskrit, Tibetan, and multiple Asian languages, where they're choosing their words with tremendous insight, they do speak of withdrawing inwards. Withdrawing inwards. But now where? Inside the heart, the brain, the throat? No, not in physical space. But just as we say, I am now going to look outwards and I attend to you. And that's good English. I'm just sitting here quietly, but then Miles caught my attention. And there's that sense of coming out, right? I mean, and you're there you are, 12 feet away. So that's out, hi, over there, right? And likewise, I hear a bird, the sound of a bird, or the air conditioning. Oh, where's that coming from? And we're looking out. Where is it coming from? Probably multiple shafts up there. And then we have that sense of coming out. Where's the air conditioning sound coming from? And that out. Where's that fragrance coming from? When we, in just a few minutes, go over to the canteen. Oh, where's that coming from? Well, we know where it's coming from, you know. And so it's coming out. Well, if that's all meaningful speech, to say I'm going out to the smells, the sounds, the tastes, and so forth, this is not that. It's just the opposite. And the opposite of out, we call in, but it's not inside the body, because the body is out. It's still out, right? It's not thoughts and images. That's out. It's still attending to something, going out to look at that thought, that image, that memory, and so forth. So it's simply a withdrawal from all appearances. Yeah, away from, yeah. But again, it's just as long as one is not confused by the words. They often say withdraw inwards. Okay, fine. But now let's not be deluded by that. Inwards just means not outwards. Pull away from outwards and what's left over. And this is really by a process of exclusion or elimination, process of elimination. When you're not attending to any appearances, including the appearances of location, then what's left over is awareness. That doesn't have a location. It just is where it is. That's why I say holding its own ground, resting in its own place. But release all notions, all concepts, exactly. release all concepts of location. If you can imagine, if you can try to imagine, slowly, slowly dying, and all appearances have vanished, and all thoughts have vanished, and all experience of your body has vanished. It's just no experience of the body whatsoever. Does it make any sense to ask, where am I now, from your perspective? And if it does make sense, then you're not dead yet. Or you finish being dead and you're dead and gone. And once you're gone and you're in the bardo, then you're here and you're there, you're all over the place. Okay? So if one thinks of this as by a process of elimination, that can be one of the most helpful. To withdraw from all sensory appearances, withdraw from all appearances of the mind, snuff out thoughts, and now what's left? As you remain clear, luminous, discerning, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but with nothing to look at. And what's left is just awareness. Okay? Hola, so we'll go to Cecil, and then, yeah, there'll be time tomorrow. Cecil, and it'll be pretty quick. Carry on.
So with regards to this practice, I find that there's a lot of energy movement.
Yeah, big time.
And so my question is, I guess, has multiple facets, but one, is that a normal course of events?
Absolutely, yes.
And then does it have to do with lack of relaxation?
No, not necessarily. It can actually, sometimes the greatest surges, strongest surges, most energy, attention captivating surges and movements of energy in the body take place when you're in the most relaxed. You're in the supine position, going total meltdown. And then in that loosening, then the blockages in the flow of prana within the body, they start to melt away, and then you can get these big gushes, big strong movements of prana within the body. And that's just part of the process. And if you're practicing awareness of awareness, just let it be and just stay right home. Don't be getting caught up in it. If you do, then you're just doing another practice.
Okay, so that letting it be is challenging.
And oh yes, indeed.
Is it so? Because my instinct would be, oh, relax more. And that sometimes has the connotation of going back to where before the energy was happening.
Not necessarily. No, it's just as in settling the mind, you're simultaneously aware of the stillness of your awareness together with the movements of the mind. Here, there may be all kinds of things happening in the body, but you're not deliberately giving any attention to them, and you are remaining still with your awareness withdrawn as much as you can. Mm-hmm. Again, just bear in mind, it's not until stages 7, 8, 9 that these sense appearances really start to dissolve away, you know, kind of big time. Until then, just kind of get used to it. Tactile sensations will arise, the visual, the auditory. They're going to be your neighbors, but you don't deliberately give attention to them when you're doing this practice.
Okay, so that's helpful. So really it's ignore.
Yeah, we're ignoring everything. We're ignoring everything except for one thing. And that's what we knew already. So once again, process of elimination. What you know right now, without being even explicitly aware of it, is right now you know you're aware, with really light emphasis on you, you know, the personal pronoun. But right now you already know you're experiencing awareness. You know, and that was before I said it. It was already there. So this is a matter of peeling away everything else you know and peeling away everything else you may be attending to and leaving just one thing standing. And that's what was already there. So the notion of acquiring, oh, what do I need to do to acquire the awareness of awareness so I can find the object? Don't acquire. Give up all your acquisitions and see what's left. And that's the one thing, apart from just falling asleep, going comatose, having brain damage, going vegetative, that's the one thing you can't, or just falling asleep, of course, into deep dreamless sleep, then you don't know anything. But as long as you're awake, that's the one thing you can't just stop doing. That awareness of awareness is kind of there. It's there. Okay.
So one last follow-up with that. Then if I notice some of this energy coming up, but then becoming stuck or pressure building up, I guess, it doesn't sort of flow.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a recommendation for that?
Yeah. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. There will be an answer. Let it be, let it be. That's it. Just let it work itself out, you know. It'll sort itself out if you just get out of the way. That's really good news. You don't have to be that clever. You just have to let it be. Good.
Thank you.
Enjoy your evening.